Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The future of healthcare in Vermont has become a key issue in this year's race for lieutenant governor. The progressive Democratic candidate, Dean Korn, is a longtime supporter of having Vermont become the first state in the country to implement a single-payer system. Incumbent Republican Phil Scott says he's skeptical about single-payer, and he wants to see the details about the plan before making a final decision. And Scott is very disappointed with the dismal rollout of Vermont Health Connect, the state's healthcare exchange.
And I think at this point in time, with the economy the way it is, that businesses are looking for some certainty, and this doesn't do it for them. So I'm, again, hoping that common sense will prevail, and this one-size-fits-all approach would be reconsidered.
So is single-payer the right approach for Vermont to take? This is one of many issues we'll discuss today with Dean Korn. Dean, great to have you here.
Thank you, Bob.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. We're going to be talking about healthcare reform, property tax burdens. We'll also be talking about economic development issues. This is a great opportunity for you to ask a question of Dean Korn, and you can do that by giving us a call at 1-800-639-2211. If you want, send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better yet, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Well, Dean, as I mentioned, you're a longtime supporter of single payer. It was an issue when you were a member of the legislature back in the mid-1990s. Why are you so convinced that making this enormous change to Vermont's healthcare system is the right way to go?
Well, Bob, this has been an issue that's been studied for now a very, very long time. We actually were looking into it, folks in and around the legislature in the late 80s to a great degree, and then in the 90s, we had enough studies to show us that this was the only way to go that would really make sense economically for the state of Vermont. Back then, in the mid-90s, we were looking at Vermont spending $1.4 billion in total health care spending. But the escalation rate of that was such that we were worried what would happen to Vermont individuals, Vermont families, Vermont businesses, once we got to the $1.6 billion and then $2 billion range. Well, a lot of looking has gone into it. There have been a lot more studies, and no serious action has yet taken place other than the legislature decided several years ago that we would go in the direction of single payer because that's the only way to maintain quality, ensure that everyone has their own choice of healthcare provider, and be able for the state economy to afford it. It's now $5 billion in total spending, and it's going to go to 6 and 7, 8 if we don't take some action to slow the growth rate and to put Vermonters in control and stop spending the money that we're spending on health insurance premiums through insurance companies.
So if we looked at the work of the Green Mountain Care Board over the last few years, and they were created through Act 48, the law that you were talking about, we would see hospital budgets increasing about 3% a year for 3 years in a row. And the chairman of the Green Mountain Care Board, Al Gobet, says, you know what? We're turning the corner on costs in the state of Vermont. If that's the case, then why move to single payer?
Well, in any given year, there may be all sorts of factors that affect the actual growth rate in that given year. The long-term trend is very, very clear. And there are many things that the simply are not part of hospital budgets that are a great deal of healthcare spending in Vermont. So there's much more that we can do for ourselves as a community of 626,000 people that is a big enough size to be actuarially, statistically significant and be able to get us some negotiated good rates for various things, including drugs. But it is not too big as to be unmanageable. And, of course, there are companies that themselves self-insure, which is a really another way to approach it for Vermont, rather than going out and sending all of their employees and subsidizing that to private insurance companies.
So I went back and I looked at the goals of Act 48. One is universal access. And before the Affordable Care Act, roughly 93% of Vermonters had access to health care. With the Affordable Care Act, it's projected it's up around 95 or 96%. Costs must be contained, and we've seen that in the last 3 years. The system should be transparent, and the Green Mountain Care Board has a plan to achieve this goal with the publication of the price of services all around the state. Act 48, another goal was the system should be publicly financed. And if you looked at the Affordable Care Act and state subsidies along with the federal subsidies, you got more than $300 million coming to Vermonters to offset the cost of health care. And Act 48 called for payment reform, and we're seeing that now in the state of Vermont with the creation of some accountable care organizations. So some people think, hey, we're meeting the goals of Act 48 right now. We don't really need to go any further.
Well, we're meeting some of them, but we're not meeting them sustainably. The Affordable Care Act is certainly covering more people. It's meeting some of those objectives. However, it's doing it at an extremely high cost. It's a very expensive Band-Aid on a non-system. We're still wasting money on insurance companies that we could be putting into Vermonters' health care. And it also doesn't get to what you can get once you have a really comprehensive system. And as opposed to universal that covers everyone, you know, under the Affordable Care Act, folks are essentially forced to buy private insurance and then subsidized by the government on top of that, on top of the costs that we're already paying and on top of the costs that are coming from the federal government in terms of Medicare and Medicaid payments. So this is not a recipe for ultimate cost containment, because the big savings are once you have a comprehensive system, and this is really what drives me, this is what's exciting to me about Vermonters getting control of their healthcare system, is that down the road, the real savings kick in through having our really well laid out plans for preventative medicine that reduces costs in the long run, and also our approaches to treating chronic illness that can really save a lot of money down the road by avoiding things like unnecessary hospitalizations, things that are not handled well by the insurance model that Vermont can do as its own healthcare system. Also, there are other exciting elements that really reduce costs. You talk about changing the payment models, and that's something that Vermont is going to be doing regardless of what else happens and needs to be done. And probably we'll end up with some hybrid system that'll be the most optimal way to reimburse providers for the services they do. But one of the really exciting things is that by having a comprehensive system, and we also have a medical school, we're able to target the kind of providers we need, whether it's doctors or nurses or nurse practitioners, to the services that we need in Vermont. And we can help with their training. We can also make sure that providers, therefore, are cost-effectively located in areas of Vermont that are underserved, and really integrate the educational with the healthcare delivery aspects of the system.
Let's go to our listeners and start off with Jim, who's calling from Waitsfield. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Good. So I have a question. It seems to me that Vermont is way too small to, and I have to preface this by saying I actually think that we should have national health care. I think Vermont is way too small to institute a single-payer program. And, you know, we are not even the size, an average congressional district in this country is 710,000 people. You just said the population of Vermont is 626,000. We are not even a congressional district. We're not even a fair-sized healthcare insurer. You know, I don't think I went to high school in a boys' high school in Boston that drew kids from five congressional districts. So the market area for that high school was five times as big as Vermont. We are not big enough to sustain a healthcare system. I don't know if you remember, but there was a fire at a nightclub in Rhode Island that burned a lot of people. That fire put out of business like three insurance companies because they didn't have the reserves to cover the victims. So how is the state going to come up with the reserves, and how does Dean think that we can do this with such a small population?
Okay, Jim, thanks for your phone call. We mentioned the 625,000 Vermonters, roughly, but that's not actually the number in the pool, because you got to back out of that the 110,000 Vermonters who are on Medicare.
Well,
and you've got another 110,000 Vermonters, roughly, who are in the ERISA federal self-insurance pool. You get about 50,000 Vermonters who get their coverage from out of state, and another 30,000 Vermonters who get their coverage through the military. So what you've really got is about 300,000 people.
300,000 people that you're covering anew, but this would also be folding in and wrapping around the Medicare and Medicaid population within Vermont, and that money comes from the federal government under waivers that are part of the good part of the Affordable Care Act, was that it provided for us getting waivers to be able to do this ourselves. So all that money is folded up. But to get to Jim's question, which is a really excellent question, there are many businesses that have fewer employees than we have citizens in the state of Vermont who self-insure. They save a lot of money and have much more cost-effective health insurance for their employees by doing it that way. And that's really how we can think of it as Vermont. We're self-insuring. We know we're big enough to have enough people to know how many bad gallbladders we're going to have next year, and broken legs and broken arms. And we can budget for those things in advance and pay, and simply pay for them, as opposed to having many levels of insurance companies each extracting their own payments, not only for their profits, but to hire all those people who are on the phone trying to deny you care. On top of that, what a self-insurance plan will typically do is take out actually an insurance policy on a catastrophic situation where, you know, 10% of the people in Vermont suddenly have heart attacks, and it would actually be insured against that. That insurance is not very expensive because you're insuring against things that are extremely unlikely. As I say, our numbers are large enough to have the actuarial data. Now, another different approach that people have mentioned for insuring Vermonters is to sort of work from the ground up and say, well, look at the health plan for the Vermont State Employees Association. They cover about 20,000 people, including their retirees. It's very cost effective. It's very good coverage, and it's very efficient. And that could be scaled up to include all of Vermont. All of these things are essentially interchangeable ways of approaching the same thing.
And yet with the VACA plan, we found out this week that the cost for the next year, this self-insurance plan, 17.9%.
That's right. That's right. And that's going to keep happening as long as we're broken up into little pieces.
So it would take about $2 billion, I understand, to finance a single-payer system. And this would be money that would replace existing premiums. Very important to mention that. So I think a lot of our listeners would like to know, since you've studied this for 20 years, how are you going to pay for single payer?
Right. And, it's talked about as if it's some gigantic mystery. And we're all waiting with bated breath as to, what's the plan that the governor is going to put out. And the fact of the matter is we pretty much know what it's going to look like. To put that in context, that $2 billion is the piece that would be financed by the state through taxes. Right now, we're spending about $5 billion a year. $2 billion of that is what gets replaced. That's what we pay out of pocket when we're sick for deductibles and copays and other payments, and also what we pay for premiums to buy insurance. That's money we're paying now. All of it is, in fact, money we're paying now. But that $2 billion would be replaced by $2 billion worth of taxes. And those taxes are really fairly straightforward, because you have to, as a fundamental principle of taxes, you can't have a sudden dislocation. You have to pretty much match the flows that we have now. So some of that money is coming essentially from businesses. Many businesses provide health care and they pay for some of that health care cost. The average payment of businesses that provide health care is about 15% of their payroll. Very, very high. And what this would do is be somewhere around the midpoint of that, somewhere around half of that. Now, there's certainly some businesses that are not providing health care now, and they would be asked to step up. But also, people should keep in mind, on the payroll tax side, it's necessary to alleviate pressure at the very bottom end. So companies with 1, 2, 5, whatever the legislature decides, and again, it's the legislature's decision, not the governor's, ultimately, what will be in the act, to make that fair so we don't put small businesses out of business. Many small businesses struggle and try to provide health care for their employees. Many simply can't. And balancing all those interests is terribly important. The other portion of the payments are now going to come essentially from the same flow they're coming from now, individuals through the income tax rather than through checks they pay to an insurance company and out-of-pocket expenses when they get sick.
So would you see, I think you mentioned maybe a 7 or 8% payroll tax for businesses, then Vermonters would use the income tax, some kind of surcharge to pay for their share. But if most businesses now that offer insurance, if it's representing 15% of their payroll and you only assess a 7.5% or 8% payroll tax on them, where's the rest of the money going to come from?
Right. Some businesses will be winners and some will be losers, and the legislature can ask some of the winners to share some of that money with their employees. It's also another aspect of this. No one ever said this is simple, but it's stuff that people have been thinking about for 3 decades now very intensely. And, of course, it's the way it's done in the rest of the world, so the rest of the developed world. So we're very unique and have a very complicated system now. But under a single-payer system in the transitional portion of it, the legislature may ask companies to share some of that benefit with employees. And those who have collective bargaining agreements, who have essentially traded away some of their income for health care benefits, they need to be made whole and treated fairly also.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Paula in Enosburg Falls. Hi, Paula. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to clarify something earlier, Bob, when you said 95% or so of Vermonters are now have access to health care. That's actually not accurate. They have insurance plans, but because of high deductible plans, which is what a lot of people can afford, they actually have to spend, you know, $3,000 or $5,000 before they get to the benefit of the insurance plan. So they don't really have great access to health care, and that's true for a lot of Vermonters. So I think you need to take that into account when you're looking at what we have now is not really adequate for lots and lots of people. I have a friend who bought a very expensive plan for 1 year because they knew they needed a procedure that year, and now they can't afford to stop working because otherwise they won't be able to pay for the premium, so they can't have the procedure because they can't take off that much time from work. So that gives you just one example of many, many stories like that.
Sure, Paula, that's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. I think in almost every show that we've done about healthcare in the last year, certainly since the advent of the Affordable Care Act, we have folks call up and say, well, the deductible might be somewhat reasonable, but the potential out-of-pocket cap is 3 or 4 times the deductible, and it's really, if people have to access the healthcare system, they've got a lot of money that they can be responsible for. So, Paula, thank you very much for bringing up that point. And is that one of the flaws, do you think, in the Affordable Care Act, the out-of-pocket expenses are so huge?
Absolutely. The plans are remarkably poor for any Vermonters who've looked at them, actually, the bronze, silver, and gold plans, particularly the silver, which is considered the standard, is really not that good when you look at actually the expenses that you actually have to pay out to be covered, not just covered, but actually get treatment. And to me, copays and deductibles are sickness taxes. And, you know, when we talk about shifting some of this money, we're just shifting it onto Vermonters. And it makes a lot more sense in terms of equity, and it makes a lot more sense in terms of overall cost effectiveness if we get rid of these incentives to game the system, to change plans because you know something's going to come up. That just makes the whole insurance concept fall apart. And then there are other, you know, tremendous advantages to having a plan that just covers everything for actual healthcare needs. It reduces the value, for example. I mean, one of the complaints that was brought up many times in the 80s is, oh, our healthcare system is expensive because of malpractice lawsuits. Well, certainly people have to be protected against malpractice on the part of providers, but that's, of course, a very rare circumstance through our licensing procedures. And when you're simply covered for care as a matter of being a Vermonter, then suddenly the value for lawyers to go out and do frivolous lawsuits disappears. So you save a lot of money in all sorts of ways that are not obvious. And then, of course, also her friend, Paula's friend, if they wanted to change jobs, they'd be free to change jobs and do what they're most productive at. Any economist will tell you that our population will be more productive if they can work at a job they want to work at rather than one that they're trapped in because it happens to provide health care benefits.
Today in the program, our guest is the Progressive Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Dean Corn. Our phone number here is 1-800-639-2211. We've been talking about health care. We're going to shift gears when we come back and talk about economic development, talk about property tax burdens, and whatever else you want to talk about. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is the Progressive Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Dean Corn. 1-800-639-2211 is our phone number if you'd like to ask Dean Corn a question. Another very important issue for you, and your campaign literature highlights this, you say that poverty in Vermont is, quote, shockingly high, and that the middle class has lost ground and is shrinking. And a lot of studies would show, I think, in the last 20 years, many middle-income families have had very, very little growth in their salaries and their overall household income, while upper-income people have enjoyed a pretty healthy increase. So is the solution to this problem making sure that everybody has a so-called livable wage and perhaps a higher tax burden on wealthy individuals?
I think the short answer to your question, Bob, is yes. But there are other things that we need to do long-term to solve this problem. We have, as you mentioned, we've had a slipping of the middle class, and certainly the lower 20% have been really stagnant and suffering. And then the economic collapse in 2008-2009 ratcheted everyone down tremendously, and then the wealthy recovered very, very well since then. The middle class has been just treading water. One thing we need to do And the numbers are very clear. We now have basically a quarter of Vermont's population getting subsidized food in some form or another. And that really ought to shock all of us. But we can get out of this mess. Long term, we need to make higher education more affordable for all Vermont kids. And we're making progress in that direction. And we need to go further with that. And I think the mechanism we can use in that case that doesn't rely on taxes per se is basically to make a revolving loan fund for tuition so that tuition at state schools is income-based. And those who do really well end up paying more for their tuition because it turned out to be at least economically, very beneficial for them, and those who do less well pay less for their tuition after the fact. And that's the kind of thing we can do long-term to help get Vermonters to a higher level of education so that they can earn more. Now, in the short term, we've made some progress on the minimum wage, moving it towards a living wage, but it's nowhere near a living wage, and we still have to keep pressure on that to move it upward.
So what do you say to those small business owners who say, you know, I would love to offer a livable wage to my employees, but if I do, I'm either going to have to cut my workforce or I'm going out of business?
I think that we have to remember that we're talking about human beings here, and human beings need to eat, and they need shelter, and they need a certain amount of dignity in order to survive. And it's just not adequate to say that, well, I should be able to pay anybody whatever I want to pay them. You know, back in the old days, in the 80s, I used to joke about how the chamber always thinks the minimum wage is perfect because you would talk about an increase, and they say, oh, no, you can't possibly increase it. And they say, oh, well, it would be better if we lowered it. And they say, oh, no, we're not arguing for lowering it. Of course, now there are some who really want to get rid of it altogether and lower it entirely. But as we move to a livable wage, there are other things the legislature could do to help out small businesses and, again, to make kind of a revolving pool that would help businesses that can afford to pay more, help smaller businesses that can't afford to pay more so we can get the job done here. Vermont, it's part of its economic development that we're talking about in terms of the high-tech economic development. If we go the way we think we can go and we can help catalyze and help support what some of the things that are spontaneously going on in tech now, we can get a much greater range of well-paying jobs in Vermont.
Let's look at property tax burdens. You say that Vermont has a crisis right now in property tax burdens and that many middle-income households are really facing just a crushing burden of taxation. Now, the state right now does have a program known as income sensitivity that allows households that have less than $90,000 in income to pay their school taxes based on their income rather than the value of their property. It's about a 2.5% surcharge on their income based on the spending levels in the individual communities. Now, there are a number of Democrats at the State House, and they talked about this last session, who want to raise the cap to perhaps $120,000. But you want to get rid of that cap altogether.
Right.
Why does that work?
Well, it works because it would be nice if everyone was paying on the same basis. And what the property tax does, and it's just so weird because everybody knows, or at least the majority of Vermonters know, that the property tax is an incredible burden. But it's so complex that it's hard to figure out exactly why. But if we strip down all the complexity from above it, what we find is underneath what the property tax does fundamentally is guarantee that the wealthiest folks pay the least as a percentage of their income. Now, in the modern era, unlike the 18th and 17th century, in the modern era, we understand that ability to pay is based on income. It's not based on, you know, how many pocket watches you have. And you pay all taxes with your income, with very rare exceptions. And so a property tax is just brutally indifferent to one's financial circumstances. And what happens is that with the property tax basis, the very wealthiest might be paying on the order of 0.5% of their income for school taxes, while the lowest income folks are paying 2.5% and up. I mean, it could be 3% of their income. And then what's happened since Act 68, which went into place in the last Republican administration, is that any increases, any and all increases, have been pushed on to those just above the cap of $90,000. And keep in mind, that's homestead income, not individual income. That's for the entire homestead. So if you have three folks living in a house together, and each making $30,000, they're at the cap. So what happens is that middle income group is getting all of the increases. And that's what's so wrong with having that cap. It's very similar to the cap on Social Security payments, where after a certain amount of income, like $110,000, you don't pay any more after that. So the wealthy never pay anything above that. So by eliminating it altogether, you put everybody in the same boat, and everybody feels the same tax rate, and everybody feels the same increases as school budgets are voted on.
So help me understand if I've got this correct. Let's say I have a household income of $200,000. And my property tax bill, because I have some money, is roughly $8,000 for my school taxes. But if I take around 2.5% of my income, that $200,000 income, that's $5,000. so I'll be able to pay $5,000 in school taxes instead of the $8,000 I would be paying on property taxes?
Probably not, because what would happen is, let's in the first instance treat this all as revenue neutral. We're just changing the tax structure, which I argue is the fundamental problem here, not exactly what school budgets are passing in places. Because this year we've seen places where school boards did nothing but cut their budgets so that they had a very minimal or no increase at all, and the property taxes skyrocketed in any case because of the functioning of Act 68. But in the first instance, let's talk about just purely revenue neutral change. What would happen when you get rid of the cap and apply that formula to everyone is that you have to change what the rate is to get the same amount of money across the board. And there may also be a phase-in period and that kind of thing. Again, you don't want to have any giant cliffs that people are running into, or suddenly someone's taxes go up by a factor of four. The thing is, we are way out of whack, and middle-class folks are paying several times the tax rate of the wealthiest.
We've only got a minute and a half left. I wish we had more time to discuss this, because we have a lot of listeners who are curious about the gas pipeline in the western part of the state. Governor Peter Shumlin says it's an essential part of Vermont's transition from today's reliance on fossil fuels to renewable energy sources maybe two decades from now. Is the governor wrong?
Well, that's a really good question, Bob. The gas pipeline, if it had been proposed 30 years ago, almost certainly, and 20 years ago, maybe, that would have clearly been the case. And 15 years ago, 10 years ago, you're getting to the point where it's very questionable. Now, of course, the details under our system are left up to the Public Service Board to adjudicate and decide. But the fact is, many issues have been raised about whether making that kind of investment in long-term infrastructure for natural gas, a fossil fuel that we need to be phasing out, and Vermont's doing a pretty good job of phasing out, plus a major portion of that gas is fracked gas, so we can hardly even call it natural gas, and Vermont has a moratorium against that. So we are exporting some of our environmental damage that goes with fracking. Plus, there are many other issues. During the last 5-10 years, many new technologies have come up that may make that natural gas pipeline really unnecessary.
So you would oppose it?
Well, to me, it's not as clear-cut as that. I supported a list of measures that the local reps and senators sent to the Public Service Board, asked, and I supported the Public Service Board getting the case back and opening it up fully. They didn't do that, and I'm very disappointed in that.
It's going to be fascinating to see the results of Election Day. I'm sure you're looking forward to it as well. Dean Korn, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate it.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about how voter turnout could affect many statewide and legislative races this year. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Election Day is just a week and a half away. There are competitive races for governor, lieutenant governor, and a number of Vermont Senate and House seats. And with us now to help us sort through some of the last-minute strategies that the candidates are likely to employ is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Eric, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Good afternoon, Bob.
We hear from some election officials that they're not expecting a large voter turnout this year. It's not a presidential year. There's no U.S. Senate race at the top of the ticket. So what's your best guess about voter turnout, and how could this turnout affect some of these statewide and legislative races?
My best estimate of the turnout at this point is that it will be somewhere between 45% and 50%. That's about 10 points lower than we normally see in an off-year election in Vermont. I don't think it'll be a record low. The record low turnout was 44.7% in 1978. But it's easier to vote early and to cast an absentee ballot now than it was back in 78. So my guess is the turnout will be in the high 40% range. As for its impact on the candidates, I think where a low turnout can possibly actually have the most impact is in a close legislative race. We've seen in previous cycles there have been a number of races for the Vermont House that have been decided by fewer than 100 votes, sometimes even by only 10 to 20 votes. And there's been votes for the Senate that have been decided by maybe a couple hundred votes. And in those close legislative districts, both parties want to work as hard as possible to get their supporters out in the polls, where there's a history of close races in a district in the past.
Now, all three major political parties say they're implementing get-out-the-vote efforts. Some of these efforts are very scientific, computerized printouts. Some are the old-fashioned be-sure-to-knock-on-every-door strategy. Do you think either of the parties have an advantage in the way that they get these voters to the polls?
What I see is interesting about this year's election is that I believe on the enthusiasm side, the Republicans have the advantage. National polls indicate Republicans are more enthusiastic about this year's election than Democrats. And we saw here in Vermont that turnout in the primary was higher than usual among voters who chose the Republican ballot. So I think the Republicans have a certain enthusiasm balance. But that's countered, in my view, by the Democrats' considerable advantage in terms of technology and other resources available for the get out the vote effort. The Democrats have far more field offices. They have a more sophisticated data mining operation to identify likely voters and get them to the polls. The Democrats in particular emphasize early and absentee voting in those cases where it's appropriate. So I would say we have a sort of balance on between the two parties on in this cycle, because while the Republicans may have more enthusiasm, the Democrats have a better GOTV operation.
You know, Eric, in some parts of Vermont, there are some very spirited races for the state Senate, and in some regions, incumbent senators are running virtually unopposed. So how much of an impact does this have on turnout in those counties?
I think it makes a difference. And my view, again, is that where we see the most competitive legislative races are in areas of the state where Republicans have done historically rather well. That's the northern part of the state and Rutland County. And although there were Republican candidates in only about half the district statewide, I think they did a reasonably good job in recruiting candidates in the competitive parts of the state. In effect, what the Republicans have done is sort of written off whole regions of the state, particularly south of Route 4 when it comes to legislative candidates, with the exception of Rutland County south of Route 4. So they're focusing their efforts on districts and parts of the state where Republican candidates for statewide offices have done well in the past, and it's possible that if they emphasize turnout in those areas, they might be able to, at the margin, pick up a few seats in the legislature that they might not otherwise have won.
Let's turn our attention to the governor's race, Eric. In the last 2 weeks, Republican Scott Milne has had two press conferences to unveil major policy plans. One had to do with education spending. Another one was economic development. Does it help Milne to finally propose some specific policy ideas?
Well, I think the Milne campaign has been doing better in the last couple of weeks than it had for much of the campaign. He's holding press conferences, as you note. He's getting news coverage for those press conferences. He's advertising more. He's up on television now from now until the election. So I think the Milne campaign is in a better situation than it was, say, a month or so ago. However, Shumlin is outspending him on the airwaves by a factor of about 2.5 to 1, it seems, in these final weeks of the campaign. And while Milne has introduced policy proposals, they've not in all instances been thoroughly thought through or costed out, and that opens up vulnerabilities to criticism from Shumlin and his supporters. So my sense is that the Milne campaign is, while it's better organizationally in terms of the candidate's own performance than it was earlier, there's still a pretty substantial gap between Governor Shumlin and Scott Milne, and Milne is on the short end of that gap.
Now, Eric, we had an unusual thing happen in the governor's race recently. Scott Milne met with Dan Feliciano and Caledonia Senator Joe Benning, and the purpose of the secret meeting was for Milne and Benning to encourage Feliciano to drop out of the race in order to enhance Milne's chances of winning. Were you surprised by this development? What do you make of this?
Well, first, Feliciano has no interest in dropping out of the race. In fact, in an interview he gave a reporter earlier this week, he said he's likely to run again for something in 2016, perhaps run for governor again or maybe run for U.S. Senate that year. the dynamics of the race are such that an argument for Feliciano to drop out doesn't make that much sense. Where an argument to a third-party candidate to drop out does make sense is when, A, that third-party candidate is sufficiently well-funded that he's getting, say, at least 10% in the polls, B, where public and other polling shows that the third-party candidate is drawing more votes than the margin between the two major party candidates, and that the third-party candidate's withdrawal from the race might lead to a different outcome between the two major party candidates. And none of those circumstances apply in Vermont right now. A public poll that we have shows Dan Feliciano polling at 6%, which is smaller than the gap between Shumlin and Milne. And Feliciano has been having trouble getting traction since the Republican primary. He's not raised as much money as he would like. He's not getting as much media attention as he would like. So his support has sort of been dwindling away of its own in the days since the Republican primary.
Some people who heard about this secret meeting said, well, it makes a lot of sense to them. Other people expressed surprise that the candidates themselves were involved in this discussion and not members of their campaign team. Does this whole thing strike you as being a little unusual?
Well, in other states when there's been discussions about withdrawals, and for example, in the Kansas Senate race, different situation, different office, but in the Kansas Senate race, the Democratic candidate withdrew, and news accounts of those sorts of things indicate that these discussions typically take place at the staff level or at supporter level first, and then they get escalated to the level of the candidate. My sense, some of the news reports on this meeting indicate that Senator Joe Benning, a Republican of Caledonia County, was one of the people behind it. And I think he was thinking about the long-term future of the Republican Party and some of the conflicts that have been evident in the Vermont Republican Party for the past year or so, since there was a contested election for party chair, and there are different wings of the party that have different views about what the party strategy should be going forward.
So does this meeting between Feliciano, Milne, and Benning indicate to you that there's still a pretty serious rift in the Republican Party?
Yes, I think there is. And we saw that in the Republican primary for governor, where Feliciano got 15% of the vote. We may see it again whenever the party has its organizational meeting again, and David Sunderland, the party chair, will be up for another term. Again, I think a lot of how this plays out will depend on what the results of the election are. I mean, one could make an argument that even if Scott Milne comes in second in the gubernatorial race, if he does manage to hold Peter Shumlin to below 50%, if Milne can finish within, say, 8 to 10 points of Shumlin, you know, get up into that single-digit range, if the GOP picks up a few seats in both the Vermont House and the Vermont Senate, and Phil Scott gets reelected comfortably as lieutenant governor, that could be seen as a reasonable, successful outcome for the Republican Party, considering where they started from earlier this cycle.
We'll know the answers to a lot of these questions in about 10 days. Retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
This week started off with a big business story, IBM's deal to offload its Essex Junction plant to Global Foundries. Also this week, we learned the rules that the state is writing for the new GMO labeling law. A well-known Rutland police chief announced his retirement. Vermont earned an average grade for the quality of its public infrastructure, and Alan Prue was found guilty of the murder of a popular school teacher, Melissa Jenkins. These were some of the voices in the news this week.
Global Foundries is in the chip-making business. Both research and development will remain in Vermont. Manufacturing will remain in Vermont.
IBM is shrinking in a growing market. They're following other people who have taken the lead. So it's hard to see profitable industries where IBM is a leader.
If you want to be in compliance with the law, you're going to put it on the same part of the package where the nutrition facts label and the ingredients list already live, so that somebody who's interested in getting this information knows where to look. It's easy to find. But it's not a warning.
You know, I've been a public servant for 40 years, and for the last 20 years, I've been in high-profile jobs, and, you know, it's time to get out of the spotlight for a while.
Obviously, not everybody's excited about a C report card, but the problem is we're right now, as a country, dealing with aging infrastructure.
What's cost effective is replacing an 1873 water main rather than repairing it four different times.
When the jury forewoman read the guilty verdicts, everyone was trying to not hoot and holler, but they all turned to each other and hugged and cried, and police shook hands and people patted each other on the backs. And all the while this was going on, Alan Prue sat at the defense table and just hung his head.
You can explore all these stories and more news at our website, vpr.net. That's Vermont Edition for today. On Monday, family-owned forests. Vermont is one of the most heavily forested states in the country, and over half of this land is family-owned. We'll hear about the challenges these family forests face and the best practices that can be employed to keep them sustainable. Join us on Monday for this discussion. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Sengary, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed this show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.